Early in his life, Bobby Fischer achieved an impressive number of distinctions. He was the first chess player as young as 13 years and 4 months to achieve the rank of master. At 14, he became the youngest player ever to win the U.S. Open chess tournament, and at 15, he became the youngest grandmaster in the world. He achieved fame and notoriety beyond the world of chess in 1972 when he defeated Boris Spassky and became his game's world champion. In Endgame, subtitled Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness, Frank Brady explores the life of the exceptional and sometimes repellent Fischer. Frank Brady joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for inviting me.
In Endgame, you discuss at length Bobby Fischer's triumphs as a very young player. Did you get the sense of what particular qualities enabled him to become so proficient so early at chess?
Well, first of all, he was probably the foremost student of the game that has ever lived. As a child, he dedicated himself to reading every chess book that was in the Brooklyn Public Library, and there were hundreds. He taught himself languages like Russian and Serbo-Croatian and others so that he could read foreign chess publications and follow the games. The other part of it is that he did have an astronomical IQ. It was 180. He could seek patterns. He saw patterns. He could look very deeply into a particular position. I think most people look one or two moves ahead. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you can see three or four moves ahead. He could look as high as 20 moves ahead, or sometimes more. And then he also had a tremendous passion for the game. Mm. He loved it. He once said, chess is life, and that's what it was for him.
Tell me a little bit about how the chess establishment in New York and Brooklyn and elsewhere came to realize Bobby Fischer's gifts.
Well, first of all, we saw the way that he played and his concentration and his seriousness involved in the game. At first, nobody thought he was going to become champion of the world, but he really caught on after a while and started slaying dragons. I mean, he was winning game after game, tournament after tournament as a child. But then at the Marshall Chess Club, he played a game that was later referred to as the game of the century. It was so brilliant, and he looked so deeply, and it was so daring that it really has never been matched in chess since then, and that's over 50 years ago. And it was published all over the world, and even the Russians sat up. Chess was certainly the national pastime in Russia. As he began to play, people said, well, who is this nobody playing and beating the U.S. Open champion? That really accented his growth.
You say he was a child playing that game. Do you remember precisely how old he was?
He was about 13.
Wow. The famous match in Iceland against Boris Spassky in 1972 is memorable for Fischer's triumph, of course, but it's perhaps as memorable for the series of delays that he caused, the string of demands that he imposed on the organizers of the match. Did this behavior result from Bobby Fischer's need to be the center of attention even when he wasn't actually playing chess?
I don't think it had anything to do with him wanting to be the center of attention. He actually despised publicity. He felt that as long as he held out, that the prize fund would be raised, and by God, it was. Hmm. And all of a sudden, instead of people playing for the world's championship for a few thousand dollars, they were playing for $250,000. So that was part of it. The other part of it is that Bobby looked upon chess as a concert pianist looks upon playing a sonata on the stage of Carnegie Hall. Everything had to be right. You couldn't sit near him. You couldn't make noise. You couldn't have television or still cameras clicking away to disturb him. He wanted everything to be precise. And if he didn't have it, he just wasn't going to play.
Bobby Fischer provided lots of reasons for refusing to defend the championship that he won in 1972. What seemed to you to be the most convincing of those reasons?
Well, the convincing reason was that he wanted something like 139 different things done, and the World Chess Federation agreed to like 138 of them, he felt that if he made a demand, that was it. So was it unreasonable? Maybe, but he did, in reality, elevate the game because now prizes are higher, conditions are so much better, lighting is so much better. There's not that much noise anymore in tournaments, so that the great players can play in complete confidence.
In the subtitle of the book, you characterize Bobby Fischer as, quote, falling to the edge of madness. But this is a man who publicly and continuously denied that the Holocaust had happened, a man who celebrated the 9/11 attacks in a radio broadcast, more than once, actually, a man who eventually came to believe that virtually everybody he'd ever befriended and who had befriended him was plotting against him. Doesn't that sound like madness rather than the edge of madness?
Well, it's a very delicate distinction. Bobby was certainly paranoid. The anti-Semitic statements that he made, the anti-American statements that he made, was undeniably, they were obscene, they were outrageous, they were not acceptable. They were awful. I interviewed a psychiatrist in Iceland who was with Bobby during the 3 years that he lived there. He was not treating Bobby. He was a friend of Bobby's and a very honest and reliable person, Dr. Magnus Skulason. And he said, as far as he was concerned, he was not psychotic and he was not schizophrenic. He was paranoid, and he was a deeply disturbed and troubled man. So that's about as far as I can go with it.
As you mentioned, Bobby Fischer spent the last few years of his life in Iceland, and you characterize Iceland as, quote, a country that really wanted Bobby Fischer, one of the few. Yet at the end of his life, you write that Fischer regarded all Icelanders as, quote, cheaters and betrayers. What brought him to that conclusion?
Well, the best quote I think I can give you that Bobby ever said that explains him is at one point he said, I am always on the attack. Always on the attack. He didn't just mean on the chessboard. He meant in every situation. It's possible that a lifetime of chess, when you have to be attacking, sort of molded him into that. But no matter how well you befriended him, no matter what you did for him, eventually he would find a way to dispute you. Mm. If you were in a room with him having a conversation, he would find a way to get into an argument. And not just an argument, it would be an attack. He was not a pleasant person for the most part to be with, I can tell you.
You suggest at the end of your book that Fischer's legacy, and I'm quoting now, for the world may simply be the awe that his brilliance evoked. Is that his legacy as far as you're concerned?
That's his legacy as far as chess players are concerned. Perhaps to the general public, his legacy is one of hate. Bobby Fischer was truly the greatest chess player that ever lived. And his games sparkle with brilliancy and sometimes even with humor, with depth, with poetry. Playing over a Bobby Fischer chess game, if you are a dedicated chess player, can bring tears to your eyes. They're so beautiful. So to me, I think of Bobby as a great chess player and a greatly failed human being who had tumbled from grace.
Frank Brady, the president of the Marshall Chess Club, is the author of Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. The book is published by Crown. The author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Mr. Brady, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been a pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino. Special thanks to the Only a Game Hut Hut Haiku players and to our legion of listener poets. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only A Game Radio. Our final word comes from ace haiku reader Walter Dixon.
Packers by 3 points? What? You think Roethlisberger is the rest of the city?
I can't put you for sure.
Now, to be fair, Walter read that poem at our training camp a few weeks before haiku season had begun, and Only A Game's crack staff of poetry coaches got him into shape just in time for the real thing. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.